All right, this Haftorah is a special Haftorah. And as I've been doing, I usually give a little bit of time to the regular Haftorah, which I'm not going to do much of that this week because the regular Haftorah that preempts it is very long. And it's a very special Haftorah, Parsha Zohar. The regular Haftorah for Truma just plugs into the building of the Beis HaMikdash in Sefer Melachim. Simple. Okay. There is a tradition, though, that I saw in a book called Heichal Rashi that says that Rashi's father gave him the name Shlomo, right, after Shlomo HaMelech, because at his bris, the Haftorah speaks of Shlomo being a Chacham. So that must mean that Rashi was born in Parshas Mishpatim. Shabbos Parshas Mishpatim. This would be Rashi's birthday. Why? Because the only way that you can have a bris on a day where we read the Haftorah is if you were born on Shabbos. You can only have a bris on Shabbos if you were born on Shabbos. And the last pasuk of the Haftorah of Parshas Truma, which is usually lame, but not this year. This is a very rare year all around. Usually, Parsha Zohar is Shabbos Parsha Tetzaveh. This year, we very rarely do we ever read Parsha Tetzaveh in Haftorah. In fact, I'll just tell you, reading Parsha Miketz, like we did this year, Haftorah of Miketz, because it wasn't Hanukkah, reading Parsha Tetzaveh, having a Sorbeteves on a Friday, Purim on a Friday and Pesach on a Sunday, those five together is just about once in a century events. Okay, there's a whole bunch of confluences of events that have to take place to make all of those five take place. And we are the beneficiaries because we're going to see a Haftorah next week that we very rarely see. All right, this Haftorah ends, Parshas Truma's Haftorah ends with this wisdom of Shlomo. Because the fact is, between Shlomo HaMelech and Rashi, named Shlomo, Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki, is what Rashi stands for, there's no one named Shlomo. There's no one in the Talmud named Shlomo. There's no Rabbi Shlomo, right? Okay, so that comes from the Haftorah that would have been this Shabbos if it wasn't Parsha Zohar. Okay? All right, so Shaul receives the command to destroy Amalek. I must insist that any time we read a story like this that defies morality. What's the morality of killing men, women, and children, and even young babies so many hundreds of years after the event for which they are being avenged? Do we have this idea of such vicarious punishment and such summary punishment so many years later? I know the Torah says Timched Zecher Amalek. What does that mean? So I must insist that we must read this parsha together with what we call Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral traditions, of what this mitzvah entails. I would say similar to how we have to understand the battles that Yehoshua fought against the seven Canaanite nations. What were their options? Did they have options of staying and living in peace? What was that? I have to tell you right off the bat, the Torah Shebaal Peh, and as well as the Poskim, the Rambam and Hilchos Malachim, Rashi and a few places in this commentary, they all claim that the nation Amalek is not conscripted to this type of destiny without any other options. If Amalek chooses to change their ways and to live with the family of man and to erase their rabid hatred of Bnei Israel, then we can live in peace with them. Mm-hmm. In fact, Amalekim are allowed to convert. There's an Amaleki convert in Shmuel Bet, right? The Gemara says in Gittin, Bnei Bonav Shel Haman Limdu Torah B'Bnei Brak. And Haman had some children who survived, and their descendants became Talmidei Chachamim and were Rashi Yeshiva. Right? But they're Amalek. The answer is a Malik is not, it's not automatically determined that a Malik has to have the destiny described in the Torah. If a Malik continues to behave like a Malik, then we have to ask, what distinguishes a Malik more than any other nation? Surely Egypt harmed us more than a Malik. The answer is that a Malik's hatred is so powerful that they're willing to hurt us even though it hurts themselves. They don't mind causing themselves grievous damage as long as they damage us as well. Okay? That's the bitter hatred of the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, who used the rail cars to cart the remaining Jews of Hungary to Auschwitz when they badly needed those rail cars to deliver provisions and supplies to their soldiers at the front. They'll hurt themselves as long as they get to hurt Jews too. Some archaeologists claim that the Amalekim who came into to our back lines at this time were actually the Hyksos, a Semitic tribe. Amalek is Semitic. A Semitic tribe that took over Egypt, actually. They were on their way into Egypt to carve up a nation that was very badly despoiled by us. So what did they want to do with us? They weakened themselves. They didn't succeed as much as they might have because they weakened themselves in the fight with us. Okay. All right. So this is the issue with why a Molek is treated this way. So if a Molek chooses to turn things around, they can. So the oral tradition teaches that they didn't. You may ask then, so why the children weren't given this option? They didn't know any better. They didn't know to turn things around. A two-year-old can be told, do you want to behave like a Molek or not? Right? So the answer for that is yes, they were caught, they were swept up in the destiny of their parents who chose to maintain their wickedness, like the people of Sodom, like the people of the flood. Right? God gives ample chances. He's Erech HaPayim v'Rav Chesed v'Emes. But when the gauntlet falls upon those who simply spend generations and generations making things worse and worse and making the world more and more dangerous place, at some point God says, okay, we just have to have the end of a Amalek. Right? Okay. So Shmuel appoints Shaul to do this. Notice that we've been living in Israel for close to 500 years, and no one thought of committing this themselves to this mitzvah. The answer the Gemara says in Maseches Sanhedrin is that the command to fight and eradicate the evil of Amalek can only be given to a king. There's no shofet that could have rallied the tribes together the way a king can. And we see that. I think I've discussed this to you before, is that there's such a fractious nature of our people in Sefer Shoftim. No, they never fight as a unit. Right? They fight alone. Shimshon fights alone. They fight just with their own tribe. Until Shaul is able to unite all the people. Right? It reaches its worst point, its lowest point in Sefer Shoftim, where the end of Pilegesh Begiva, at the end of the story of the entire eradication of the whole tribe in Israel, the tribe of Binyamin, which not coincidentally is the tribe of the first king, right? And they were almost totally wiped out. The other 11 tribes wiped out the whole tribe except for 400 men. And the men swore that they wouldn't give their daughters over to Sheva Binyamin. So these 400 men have no one to marry, and the tribe is wiped out. So they decided that if they said they wouldn't give their daughters, it wasn't a violation of their oath to have the men of Binyamin take daughters on their own. So they took 400 women from a city called Yavesh Gilad, right? Apparently, the story takes place on Tu B'Av, says the Gemara. So Tu B'Av becomes an important day for Shiduchim. And these 400 men of Binyamin took these 400 women from Yavesh Gilad, and they carried on the tribe. When Shaul is appointed king, the Ammonites, now Ammon is way south of Yavesh Gilad, apparently they were testing Shaul. because they know he comes from Yavesh Gilad. His ancestry is Yavesh Gilad, right? Pashut Ma'od. If you're from Binyamin, you must be from Yavesh Gilad, right? So they test the people of Yavesh Gilad with a command. They say, we will only let you live. We will not fight you and destroy you. It's one lone city. Mm-hmm. Unless every male removes his right eye. Sound familiar? Every male, if we're going to come and check, if we don't see all the males missing their right eye, we're going to come in and wipe you out. Now, if you're a city in Israel, what would you do in such a case? You'd appeal to the government. What do you expect from a government? The very least, to protect me and from an incursion from a foreign entity. Mm-hmm. So luckily, thankfully for Israel, there's a king. And they appeal to Shaul, who tells all the tribes, I want you to send in reinforcements, and I want you to send in soldiers, because we want to fight the Ammonites. Right? And like Sefer Shoftim, none of them care. And Yavesh Gilad worry about it themselves. At which time Shaul took an ox, cut it up into 12 pieces, and sent one piece to each tribe of Israel. And they showed up in great numbers, over 300,000 of them, and they routed Ammon, and they saved the eyes and the lives of the people of Yavesh Gilad. You see that that Shaul is able to show initiative. He took the bull by the horns, and he saved the day. So that in the next battle against the Philistines, the prophet Shmuel tells him, wait 7 days for me, and then we'll offer a sacrifice, and then we'll prosecute the battle. Shmuel apparently purposely comes late. Shmuel is late. And Shaul says, we don't want to fight a battle without offering a sacrifice to God first. That was a common thing in the ancient world. But Shmuel is not here. And the people want to fight. They want to start the battle. Right? And Shaul is in a quandary. Shmuel told me to wait. And he's not coming. All right? Maybe he got stuck. Maybe the train is late. Maybe there's a Chifetz Chashud or something at the bus station. I don't know. But I don't know why he's late. So Shaul offers the korban himself. And then he goes and makes the battle. Just then, that's when Shmuel shows up. And he says, what's going on here? Why did you offer the korban? I told you to wait for me. And Shaul says, you can excuse him listen, the Plishtim were advancing. We're losing our advantage. And the people wanted to go. The people wanted they wanted to fight to prosecute the battle already. So Shmuel says, I'm sorry, you lost your kingdom over this. But the especially egregious part of that story replicates itself in our story. Is that when Shmuel objects to Shaul bringing the korban himself, Shaul just goes on and on and on and saying, I did what God said, I did it. No, you didn't. I told you to wait and you didn't. It's not an extremely serious infraction, certainly not along the lines of what David does. Right, but it's nonetheless the infraction I can explain is that Eilev Arecha ve'Eilev Asusim v'Anachnu B'Shem Hashem Elokeinu Nazkir. Goyim, they fight battles with warriors and with soldiers. We don't. We don't win a battle unless the prophet is taking part. You get it? We don't want the people thinking that we want a king to fight our battles and that's how we win wars. We win wars because we have the name of God with us. And Shaul, you lost the opportunity to teach that message by waiting for me, and that's enough for you to lose your kingdom. Especially since you blame it on the people. There are some Mefarshim that suggest that Shmuel might have reacted a little more kindly had Shaul taken the initiative himself and said, you know, Shmuel, you're right. He should have stood up. He did the first time. And no one wanted to show up to help the people of Yavesh Gilad. He took a strong initiative and stood up to the people. I mean, you had to go because the people didn't fight. Tune in now, our Perek. Okay? Shaul loses his kingdom over taking the spoils of Amalek. First of all, I ask you, where does it say in the Torah that you're not allowed to take the spoils of Amalek? Was this Shmuel's own initiative? Just to make up a rule that you can't take the spoils along the lines of what Yahushua did with Yericho? When he said, no one may take the spoils, and then Ochan did, and then, okay, so I took care of Ochan. But as long as Ochan took those spoils, God didn't come to the camp and they lost the next battle. It was I, right? So here is the Sifrei that says, you know, in many shuls, they read a pasuk twice. Why would we read such a variant? I don't want to give the impression that we're not sure what the right word is. We know what the Masorah is. The word is Zecher. Why not read Zohar while we're at it? Right? So why aren't we just sticking to our guns and saying, look, we have a Masorah, that's the Masorah. There's an alternate Masorah, okay? But we know what we have is the correct Masorah. So why are we suggesting that we're not sure what the word is? Right? There are many variants in the Torah, I got to tell you. All right, I get it why we're doing this one, because this is a fulfillment of a Torah law. So when the other laning of the year, all the other lanings of the year don't fulfill a Torah law, so big deal whether we get it right or wrong. I don't want to imply that we have any doubts. There are variants, but we have our Masorah, and we stick to it. Okay, well, here's the answer. The Sifrei says that there is a qualitative difference between Zecher and Zecher. Zecher Amalek means what God told Shaul to do to the people of Amalek. Zecher Amalek is a reminder of Amalek. If I would take, after fighting against Amalek, I would take their, wow, I found a nice dresser. So I took it to my house and someone goes, oh, wow, I was just here last week. I didn't see that dresser. Where did you get it? He says, oh, yeah, I took it from Amalek. You violated Timchet Zecher Amalek. Zecher Amalek means the actual people. Zecher Amalek means something that reminds you of Amalek. Right? So if you took Amalek's horse and he said, wow, where did you get that horse? I never knew you had a horse. He goes, yeah, I took it from Amalek. Oh, can't do that. Okay, the Sifrei actually gives those particular examples like that about explaining to someone where you got these spoils. Okay, so that explains why Shmuel adds this. It's part of the Torah law. So what happens? What exactly happens? Look at Pasuk Tes, please, with me. V'yachmol Shaul v'ha'om al Agag v'al meitav hatzon v'habakar v'hamishne v'al karim v'kol atov v'lo avu hachrimam v'chom alachon mevizah. Okay, the two points I'd like to make from this pasuk. One is that it says that Shaul and the people chose not to kill the king and to save the very fattest of the sheep. It doesn't say why they wanted to save the sheep. What would you say if just on the first glance? Someone say so. Why did they want to save the sheep?
Because from a sheep you can get a lot of things.
That's simplest answer. Of course, I wanted the sheep. There's this wool. There's lamb chops. There's right. So good. I'm glad that was just your initial reaction, because when Shmuel comes over to confront Shaul on this disregard of the command. Right? Why do you think he leaves the king alive? Apparently, he took care of everybody else. Why only leave the king alive? Out of sadism, forcing him to watch what you're about to do to his nation? What do you think? Maybe more likely to get a king's ransom. Right? Kings are worth a lot of money. Right? Someone is always related to a king, another king usually. So, okay, this king maybe knows where all his, the treasures are, and he'll say, hand me over to my cousin who's the king of Ammon, and I'll give you a great treasure. Have you ever king's ransom, right? Mm-hmm. Right? So if Shaul is holding on to Agag for some kind of personal gain or some kind of ulterior motive beyond God's very, very difficult, challenging mitzvah here, then I quote now Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who wrote this in an article a long time ago. He says that the real punishment of Shaul is not because he let the king alive. The punishment of Shaul is because he killed everybody else for personal gain, for the wrong reason. In other words, by leaving Agag alive, it shows that he's not performing this mitzvah out of the fulfillment of this very difficult and impossible command. He did it, but he did it for personal gain or for other ulterior motives. And therefore, the prophet is angry with him. He would have been better off just saying, God, I can't do this. Give it to someone else. Give it to the next king. Too hard for me. Okay? So Hashem tells Shmuel, Pasuk Yud Aleph, V'yomer, Nichamti ki imlachti es Shaul ha-melech, ki shav me'acharai v'estibarai lo hikim. Now, nichamti, when a person says this word, means I regret crowning Shaul king. God doesn't regret things. Okay? You ever hear of Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker v'lo yinochem? Right? Netzach Yisrael, remember there was an organization called Nili? Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker, it's Rosh Tevos. So later on, God says that. Lo yishaker v'lo yinochem, ki lo adam hu li hinochem. I don't regret things. I'm not a man. And then it says, v'yinochem Hashem. What's that? So it's the same thing when it says at the end of Parshas Bereishis that God regretted creating mankind because he's going to destroy them in the flood. Right? God doesn't regret because God knows all things and God knows what's going to happen. It's just called Dibra Torah Kalashon B'nei Adam. Mm-hmm. God speaks to us the way man speaks to man. But what does it mean? Why did God give us a king who was so not worthy in the end for the job? The answer is nobody's perfect. But the B'nai Shaul was the king the people deserved. It's the king they asked for. Mm-hmm. We always get the leaders we deserve. Okay? All right, so Shmuel was crying out to God, and God told him, enough, Shmuel. I know he's the work of your hands. I know that you're very proud of crowning the first king of Israel, right? But you've got to go to him and confront him. V'yashkem Shmuel, Pasuk Yud Beis. V'yashkem Shmuel l'kras Shaul baboker. V'yugad l'Shmuel l'mor b'Shaul ha-Karmela. Very strange ending to this pasuk. When Shmuel found Shaul, Shaul was being matziv lo yad. Mazeh. What yad is this? Have you ever seen Yad Avshalom? Do you remember what it looks like? Camille, are you able to put up a picture of Yad Avshalom for everybody? Can you look up what it is? It's called Yad.
1 second.
Yad Avshalom. It's in the old city.
A yad can be a monument.
It's a monument that you can see when you take the number 2 or the number 1 bus to the Kotel. It'll take you all around the wall, and then you come up the hill towards the Shara Ashbot. And as you're going down the hill, you can look over the side from your left side of the bus as you're coming to the Kotel, and you will see the Yad Avshalom. Whether or not it's actually the monument that Avshalom made for himself, but it's called Yad Avshalom because a yad in these contexts means a memorial. not unlike Yeshayahu's words that we'll say next Thursday, called...
I posted it in the chat, or picture.
Called Yad Vashem. It has a big, big, like a tall, just a one little thin pole that comes out of the center of the memorial. And so thanks. These are all examples of Yad. So why is Shaul putting up a Yad for himself? It's a sign that he thinks he succeeded, that I will always be remembered as the one who took out Amalek. He thinks he is 100% successful. You see the way he behaves. Let's watch. Vema Shmuel Shaul. Right? Vevo Shmuel Shaul Vayemelo Shaul. Baruch atol Hashem akimosi es dvar Hashem. There you go. Shaul comes out to greet him. I've done it. I've succeeded. Right? So Shmuel and Pasuk Dalid, perhaps exercising a little bit of humor, right, engages in what literary circles is known as an onomatopoeia. Familiar with the terminology? An onomatopoeia. Do you see it? Where he says,
"Meh."
Shmuel, right? Can anyone,
"Meh."
Right. Now, it's true that in the first time when Shmuel confronts Shaul, he also said, "Umeh," when he asked him, what's that karban that's going on, instead of saying "Uma." But okay, but here it's still, it's the sound of a bleating sheep. "Umeh kol hatzon hazeh be'oznai." So, "V'kol ha'bakor asher anochi shomea." So, line number one, "V'yemer sha'ol me'amaleki hevi'um asher chamal ha'om ma'meitav hatzon." No. That's not what Pasuk Tes said. Pasuk Tes says Ve'echmo Shaul. And here you're saying Asher Chamal Ha'am. That's not kingly.
All
right? Yeah, who's in charge here? All right? Don't blame it on the people. Come on. The Pasuk clearly says Ve'echmo Shaul. And then to make matters worse, the whole point was, according to Shaul, right? Even after Shmuel pushes back and said, "How dare you? God appointed you king, and this is your first major act, and you messed up, and you keep saying that you did it right?" Right? So after a lot more pushback from Shmuel, right, Shaul pushes back just as much in Pasuk Chaf. Let's read it. "V'yemer Shaul el Shmuel, asher shamati b'kol Hashem. I listened to God. I walked in the path that you commanded me. I just brought Agog. Why? Why? What is he here for? What did you want him for? He's lying now about why he saved Agog. Why did you keep him alive? So he could have to watch what you're doing to the rest of his nation? Right? Remember, Haman, this is why we read this now. Because Haman ha'agogi. He's called, the last time he's referenced, he's called Tzorer Kol HaYehudim. Tzorer Kol HaYehudim. Not just Tzorer HaYehudim, like he's been called all along. Tzorer Kol HaYehudim. He's like Iran that doesn't just want to kill the Jews of Israel. They want to kill the Jews of Argentina. They want to kill the Jews everywhere in the world. The Nazis, Yimach Shemam, wanted to control the world and kill every Jew in the entire world. So the Amalekim are such a threat to us that just by leaving Agog alive, and Chazal tell us that in between, during this time, he managed to father child.
Hmm.
Right? And that's that descendant is Haman. Haman ha'agogi. Get it? Okay? So then, now Shaul changes direction. Pasuk Chaf Aleph: "Vayikach ha'am me'ashalol tzonu v'kor reishis acherim lizboach l'Hashem melokecha b'Gilgal." What? He's saying that the people took the sheep in order to offer karbanos? Who said anything about Karbonos? Camellia gave a good svara just before about why he took the sheep. Because they have good wool, and we like the lamb chops. What do you mean you took him to offer Karbonos? Where does it say that? Shaul is making up stories. He's making up a story for why he wants the animals. He's making up a story for who wanted the animals. And the Chori, he's making up a story about saving Agog too. Right? So Shmuel makes the famous line, HaFetz Hashem Ba'olobizva, that God doesn't want a korban. He just wants you to listen to him. Okay? So you see what's happening. Shaul knew how to take the initiative in the very first battle with Yavesh Gilad, to save Yavesh Gilad. Mm-hmm. Right? And then in the battle with the Plishtim, maybe he takes too much initiative. He wants to be in charge. He says, I'm going to bring the korban myself. No! That korban is supposed to wait for the Navi to come along. And now he goes to the other extreme. He can't take the initiative to tell the people, listen, this was my command. Right? Whether you knew the Sifrei or not, just listen to what Shmuel tells you. In Israel, the kings take their instruction from the prophets. Okay? It's just going to be about 10 psukim from now where God commands Shmuel the next commandment, and Shmuel is afraid that if he commits himself to that commandment, Shaul will kill him for it. Pointing another king. Right? So this Nebuch, this story is about the fall of Shaul. He keeps blaming the people. But that's the king they wanted. A king who will walk before us and ride before us and fight our battles for us. Okay? So Shmuel tells Shaul that you will not only lose your kingdom for this, because when he didn't wait the requisite 7 days, Shmuel told him that you will lose your kingdom over this, but not you necessarily. You're going to rule as long as you were supposed to rule. You lose your kingdom means that you won't have a long-standing dynasty. Now, there was supposedly, Tosfos refers to this in the second parak in Sanhedrin, an oracle that there should be at least two kings from Binyamin. The basis of this oracle is that God told Yaakov, "Umelochim mechalatzecha yetzeu," the end of the sixth aliyah in Parshas Vayishlach, and only Binyamin, the fifth aliyah, and only Binyamin wasn't born yet. So Umelochim, you get it? Well, two kings will yet come from you, right? And that's that Tosfos in the second parak in Sanhedrin uses this oracle to explain why inexplicable. Why Avner would crown Ishbosheth king, even though it was obvious to everyone in Israel, as they themselves say in chapter 5 of Shmuel Bet, that everybody knew that David would be the unequivocal king of all of Israel. So why appoint this so profoundly ill-prepared Ishbosheth? He was shortly assassinated afterwards, and he was a total weakling. Right? So why did Avner crown him? To fulfill this oracle. More likely out of loyalty to his cousin, Shaul, but all right. And plus, he might have felt that Ishbosheth would be more valuable to him, considering that he's a relative. All right. So Shmuel here tells Shaul, the last time you didn't listen, I told you that you'd lose your kingdom, but not in your day. Your son's kingdom will be curtailed. Still a possibility that Shaul would have built the Beis HaMikdash. Well, no, now that you failed to rid Amalek, so now it's not going to happen. Right? Beis HaMikdash stands in the land of Binyamin. Okay? So here, now Shmuel tells him that your kingdom is going to be taken away in your time. Right? And Shmuel turns away. Shaul grabs him and Shaul's coat rips. So let's read together in Pasuk Chaf Chet. It's a very long of Torah. Chaf Chet. Vayomer Elav Shmuel. Kara Hashem es mamlechut Yisrael me'alecha hayom. This is symbolic. you tore my coat. God has torn your kingdom from you. And he's giving it to someone better than you, someone who would have waited for me, someone who would have listened to me about Amalek.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's telling him, you know, the dreaded news that you will see this happen. You will get to see your replacement. Okay? This, of course, made Shaul very paranoid. Right? Now, there's a third time where Shaul sins. And in that third time, Shmuel tells him, not only will God take away your kingdom, not only will he give it to someone better than you, he's going to give it to David. I ask you this question. Why, if here, if Shmuel is afraid of crowning David king, lest Shaul kill him for it, why wasn't he afraid to say, God is going to give the kingdom to David, right to his face? Because in the next sin, right, Shmuel tells him, God is taking the kingdom from you and he's giving it to David. It's actually a trick question. Why wasn't Shmuel afraid to tell him that? Here he's saying, he'll kill me if I crown David king. And then he said to his face, the kingdom is taken from you and given to David. Jenny, are you raising your hand to answer? Why wasn't he afraid? Yes, Camelia?
Maybe he thought it'd be after his death that David HaMelech would become king, whereas if it's taking it away, it happens while he's alive.
I'm not sure if you are purposely giving the right answer or accidentally giving the right answer. When Shmuel told him this, he was dead. Dead men don't talk. But this was actually in a story. Some commentaries say it's real. Many commentaries say it's not. But remember where the witch called Shmuel back from the dead? That's where Shmuel told Shaul, your kingdom is being ripped from you and it's given to David because, okay, now make my day. What are you going to do? You're going to kill me? I'm dead already. All right, so that's why he, in that particular third case, he's sort of in the Olam HaEmes, so he can't just say the kingdom is given to someone better than you. He has to tell the whole truth, right? So now he can't hide anything. He has to say it's being given to David, your worst nightmare. Okay? All right, but here all he says is that the kingdom is taken from you and given to someone who would have listened. Right? I'm tired of paying attention to your misappropriations. Okay. All right. So now, I also put chapter 22, verse 9. Please turn there now with me. I gave you. I hope it was. It's online, Camille. You see the second that I put there. Chapter 22, verse 9 through the end of the chapter. A little background is in order here. Shaul had become insanely jealous of David. He had already tried to kill him and make it look like an accident two or three times. He tried to kill him in the palace. He tries to kill him.
It's there, yes.
Sending him out on missions, right? So chapter 22, verse 9. The background here is that Shaul is chasing after David with thousands of men. And somehow, wherever Shaul comes to chase after David, David gets the word and is able to escape just at the last minute, which gets Shaul very angry because it makes him feel that there's a conspiracy. Yeah, everyone in Israel thought it was absolutely crazy that you're running after David, who's a loyal servant who keeps winning battles for you. So why are you trying to kill him? He's your son-in-law. Right? It's such an irony because until now, great, great leaders in Israel have had bad children. Shmuel's kids are bad. Eli's kids are bad. Aaron's kids, two of them turn bad. Moshe has kids who don't amount to anything. Great people have trouble keeping all of their children in the program. Even Yaakov, whose all children ostensibly follow after him, still ran into some serious issues with them. Well, all of them selling Yosef, right? And Shimon and Levi. So what is it about these great men? So Shaul looks at Yonason and says, Yonason, don't you realize, this is actually a quote in Shmuel Aleph, that as long as Ben Yishai is alive, you will never become king. Well, Yonason already made a pact with David. Yonason loves David. But the irony here is, I present to you, is that Yonason, I don't know if he spoke this way to his father, but Yonason could say to his father, Dad, you know, until now, great leaders had children who weren't worthy to walk in their path. The irony here is that if there's something that is keeping me from being the next king of Israel, it's not me. It's you. Right? It's not the fact that I'm not worthy to follow in your path. You made it so that I won't follow in your path. Right? So here, Shaul is very upset. And he asks his men, all from Shevet Binyamin, to go the extra mile and hand in David for me. Because if David becomes king from Shevet Yehuda, he's not going to give you all the vineyards and all the favors that I give you. This is no way to be king. To ingratiate yourself and give gifts to the people close to you. That's the way Achashverosh behaves, not a king of Israel. Right? So when Shaul says, how come none of you are sick over my pain with regards to David? Doesn't anybody know where he's hiding? So then one Russia named Doeg HaAdomi, he steps forward and says the following, Pasuk Tes, Vayan Doeg HaAdomi v'hu nitzav al avdei Shaul v'yomar. Ra'isi es ben Yishai. It's a pejorative term when you call someone the son of someone. Ra'isi es ben Yishai ban Nove el Achimelech ben Achituv. I saw him go to Nov, to the Kohen Gadol. Vayishal lo b'Hashem, line number one. He inquired of God. No, he didn't. It doesn't say in the story that he inquired of God. First of all, it's mashma from the Torah, but there's a gemara at the end of Yuma that proves it, that only the king gets to ask the Urim V'Tumim. You can't just go over to the Urim V'Tumim and say which horse is winning in the sixth race. You can't just go over to the Urim V'Tumim and ask for advice. Only the king can. Right? It has to be something that concerns the whole people. So if the high priest offered to go to the Urim V'Tumim for David, it means that he thinks David is king. Or perhaps even if not that, if you had inquired of God through the Urim V'Tumim, you would have known that David was lying to you when he said he's on a mission from Shaul. David was lying about that. Right? I don't know how you could fit that into the truth. Okay? Right, so that's line number one. Doeg HaAdomi said that David went to the Kohen Gadol, and the Kohen Gadol inquired of God and asked the Urim V'Tumim what's supposed to happen. Line number two. V'tzeda nosan lo. I don't think it's fair to call what Achimelech gave him as tzeda. He gave him some loaves of bread. That's not tzeda. Okay? Tzeda is provisions for a long journey. Okay? That's line number two. Right? Now it says, V'escher of Goliath aplishti nosan lo. Right? He gave him the sword. That is true. That's true. David asked for it. What was it doing there? Remember, the sword belongs to David. He's the one who brought it there. All right, this is a little difficult because it says in when he killed Goliath that he brought it to Yerushalayim. And here it says it's in Nov. The Radak says an amazing chiddush that wherever the Mishkan stands can be called Yerushalayim even anachronistically. Right, Yerushalayim ended up being the holy city, so whatever is the holy city until then, right? Yeshayahu turns that on its head when he says Od Hayom Benov. The Torah of the eighth day of Pesach. where he talks about the messianic figure, and he refers to Nov when he really means to refer to Yerushalayim. See the Radak there if you have a chance. Okay, so Doeg is lying about the extent to which David was helped. It's in his best interest to make it look like that the high priest did all this amazing work for David and ingratiate himself more in the eyes of Shaul. But when Shaul hears about all this, he gets very angry with the high priest, with the Kohen Gadol, and he confronts him. He says, how dare you treat and help the fugitive of the king, right? Did what was the name of the doctor that tended to John Wilkes Booth? Mudd, right? What was his first name? He had a descendant who was a reporter, Roger Mudd. Right? Does anyone ring a bell with anybody? Remember, your name is Mudd, they used to say, because the doctor didn't know that John Wilkes Booth had killed Lincoln. He just went to him and he tended to him. Right? I think there was even a trial against this doctor afterwards. Right? So the Kohen Gadol can just profess, I didn't know any of this. Right? So the king confronts the Kohen Gadol with all this information. Okay, so the king tells him, how dare you help Ben Yishai? B'sitcho lo lechem b'cherev v'sha'ul lo b'elohim l'kum elai l'orev b'kayom hazeh. That you inquired of God, again a lie. David Shaul just accepts it. In order to rise up against me. V'yan Achimelech es ha-melech v'yomar. So Achimelech, the high priest, responded. He took the high road. He could have said something like, look, I mean, he could have said something, I didn't know. I mean, I didn't inquire of God. If I had inquired of God, I would have known. Right? So he says, Hayom achilosi lishol b'elohim chalila liya, al yaseh ha-melech ba'avdo davar b'chol beis avi, ki lo yodav d'cha b'chol zos, davar katono gadol. So that's where he goes now. He says, I don't know any of this. And I didn't inquire of God for him. That's crazy. Shaul is about to kill 85, not just 85 Kohanim, 85 families of Kohanim. 85, that's hundreds of people. And look at the way that the Pasuk describes what he did to them. Okay? Pasuk Yutes says, Vesnov ira kohanim ikolafi charev me ish va ad isha me olel va ad yonik veshor va chamor va se lefi charev. What's going on here?
He doesn't have mercy when he's supposed to have mercy.
He's doing mercy Amalek, right. He's doing to the kohanim.
But he should have done to Amalek.
Exactly the pasuk that Shaul said to do to Amalek.
Sure.
When is it?
He said Shaul.
What Shmuel told Shaul to do to Amalek. Right, everyone see it? Pasuk Yutes exactly captures what the command was for Amalek. Alti tzadik harbe. Be a big tzadikal when it comes to Amalek. You'll see you'll behave that way with people who deserve some mercy. Now, look, objectively speaking, the high priest seemed to, at least the way Doeg presented it, he commits treason. He commits. He's a kesher against the king. It's a right. But that's because Shaul by this time is a megalomaniac. He's manic depression, and he's all kinds of things about losing his kingdom, and he's fighting back to hold on to the kingdom. Right. So Shaul's sins become more now just that they snowball. Okay, a small sin turns into a bigger sin. And it's like the Medrash that says, if you have mercy for people who deserve cruelty, you will end up being cruel to the people who deserve mercy. Okay. So Hashem tells Shmuel that I want you to now crown a different king. You have to change him. You know, this is a real avla. I know that you put in your so much effort into being the mamlich malachim, but I'm going to tell you to crown another king. And Shmuel expresses his lack of faith in the relationship he used to have with Shaul. He was supposed to be in charge of Shaul. He created Shaul. Right? Remember Shaul's opening discussion with Shmuel when he was looking for his donkeys? Right? How Shaul is so contrite and so humble and so, right? And then now he's gone for a very short time to someone Shmuel thinks will kill him. And he has the wherewithal. And I don't think I can stand up to him the way I did twice. And he stands up to him only after he's dead, you know, to a greater extent. But I don't know if I could stand up to him anymore. You can't talk to him anymore. And in fact, it says at the end of the story, Shmuel never saw Shaul again. Right? So, look, let's finish up the Haftorah. Pasuk Lamed Beis. Vayomer Shmuel hagishu elayes Agag melech hamalek. Vayelech elav Agag madanos. Vayomer Agag achein sar marva hamaves. Agag started to speak with dainty language. And he said, ah, the bitterness of death has passed. The prophet of Israel is here, and the prophets of Israel are always dignified and always merciful. Right? Some say, Lachain Samar Mavis means now Mr. Death has passed. Right? Mr. Death. So Shmuel says, Vemer Shmuel, Kasher Shiklo Noshim Charbecha, the same way that your sword made many a woman to be bereft of their children, came to Shakel Minoshimi Mecha. Don't think that because I came in here, that means that you're safe. My sword will make your mother to be childless. And now a Hapax Lagamana follows. Vayishasef Shmuel es Agag, ifnei Hashem Gilgal. Okay, but Shin Samach, whatever word letter you put afterwards that creates a Hebrew word, means to like cut something in half. Right, like shosa shesa means split hooves. So shvayishasef Shmuel shin samach pei is a. It's called ein lamila zu chaver. It has no friends. So hapax agamana. Right. So he cut Shmuel in half. He cut Agag. Shmuel cut Agag into pieces. Lifnei Hashem b'Gilgal. Vayelach Shmuel haramasa v'shaul alay al beiso givat Shaul. Anybody know how far Rama is from Givat Shaul? It's like you can see one from the other. They're very close. Right? If you know which way to go, it's about a mile walk. Maybe a little more. You know the remote mall? Anybody? Okay, you keep going a little further out of Yerushalayim than the remote mall, and you're going to get to where Shmuel lived. In fact, his burial place is there. Kever Shmuel is right up the road. Okay, I hate taking the bus. They call the bus stop Nabi Samuel. Come on, it's Israel. Call it Shmuel HaNavi. There's a street that's down the road called Rehov Shmuel HaNavi that goes into Sanhedrin. Right, they have to stay at Golda.
2.6 miles.
Oh really? Oh wow.
12 minutes by car.
Yikes! I didn't know it's that far. Okay, Givat Shaul is right outside the central bus station. Okay. So my and Chani lives just past there, up the road, the next town, called Givat Ze'ev, named after Ze'ev Jabotinsky. Okay, it's all these places are usually named after someone. So Ramot comes from Ramah, which is where Vahi Shechad Mina Ramatayim Tzofim, which is where Shmuel was from. So it says V'lo Yosaf Shmuel Liros Es Shaul Ad Yom Moso. Shmuel never saw Shaul again until the day he died. What does that mean? That the day he died, he did see him? Because he saw him in, when he died, right? In the chapter that begins, and Shmuel died, and then Shaul calls him back from the dead, right? I'm not sure that that's what this means, though. Right? Vashem nicham kim lichet Shaul al Yisrael. And God regretted appointing Shaul. Again, I say the philosophical notion is that God doesn't regret anything. When it says Vashem nicham, it means that either Dibre Torah kol shomim adam, God is just talking to us the way we talk to each other, or it just means that you know, I gave you the king you deserved, and what I regret is that you exercised your free will to want a king that you really shouldn't have wanted. Okay, so ends our Haftarah. It is a fulfillment of a Torah law according to many Mefarshim and Poskim to hear the Torah reading this Shabbos, and and of course the Haftorah is part of that commitment to remember what Amalek did, and we'll do that the Shabbos multiple times. And if anybody has any questions about that, by all means, please address them. And I want to thank everyone for being here. Next week we will be doing a very rare Haftorah, the Haftorah of Parshas Tetzaveh. It's usually never read, very rarely, and we'll look into the theory of what Yechezkel is doing at the last nine chapters of his book. In order to fully understand what Yechezkel is doing, I think it might be helpful if you have a chance between now and next Monday to read a small two-chapter book of Tanakh called Haggai. If you have a chance to read Haggai, okay, Haggai is also about the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, and we'll take a look at some of the issues pertaining to these two. Okay, we'll look at all Beis HaMikdash kind of prophecies, Ezra and Chemia, and we'll see what exactly what are the issues that Yechezkel is dealing with. Okay, everybody, have a great week.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Thanks for being on. Next, we have Wednesday night at 8:00. We have the Minchas Chinuch. We're up to Mitzvah number 15. So we'd love to see you there.